Thanks a lot. It's great to see so many of you out for the, I believe, last talk of the night, at least the last before the Seabase party. I'll be presenting weaknesses that we found while reverse engineering the MyFair security system for RFIDs, a project that I've been doing with Starbuck and Henrik. Let me begin with an observation. Everybody in this room own several RFID tags, and many of you even carry them with you every day. RFID tags are tiny computer chips whose whole purpose is identification. So when queried, these passively powered tags reply with their identity. And they come in all kinds of forms and shapes. You find them as stickers, labels, you find them in car keys, you'll find them in passports, and all these various applications. And we see RFID tags becoming more and more ubiquitous. Last year, RFID tags were used in the World Cup tickets. We see them in access control to buildings, in payment systems. Many metro subway systems use RFID tags now as a wireless means of payment. We see them as theft protection in cars. And that has been a trend for many years. They spread into more and more applications, including the passport that we've seen, but also human implants, where people embed an RFID tag underneath their skin, again, for means of identification. And the general trend that we observe is that RFID tags replace traditional identifiers, including PIN numbers, passwords, even biometrics, or a car key. You can buy a car now without a physical key where you only have a computerized identifier to grant you access to your car. And for all these applications, the identification itself isn't enough yet. We need some level of authentication, some security that has yet to be added to many of these applications, especially the implementable ones that are very easily clonable. Another trend that has been observed for many years now already is that, welcome Starbuck, that more and more products are tagged with RFID tags, and companies including Walmart demand in a few years from now all their products to be tagged with RFID tags. So they will virtually replace barcodes in most every application that barcode in consumer products is used today, which many of you are, I'm sure, aware of, imposes threats to customer privacy. If Walmart can track the products within the store, once you purchase them, they can track you on the street. And not only Walmart can, but virtually everybody with a $50 reading device can. Another privacy implication of this technology is that competitors, say Walmart and Target, they can spy on each other, walk through each other's stores and see the turnover of goods. So privacy goes both ways. And besides security, the implants and the passports, privacy is probably the best motivation for security on an RFID tag. Well, to privacy, people came up with all kinds of breaking, jamming, shielding solutions. But as researchers, we'd like to see more sophisticated and more fashionable solutions to this problem. So in a nutshell, we need crypto on these tags to guarantee unclonability of, for example, medication. The Federal Drug Administration in the U.S. demands your RFID tags to be embedded in medication so that you can't copy or counterfeit a bottle of medication, but then you want it to be unclonable. You also want it to be private, obviously, so that nobody knows what medication you're actually carrying. And for all this, we need crypto, but we as academics don't actually have any crypto that we know would fit on an RFID tag. And the gap that we see the tags that we see in the market either have no crypto whatsoever, they're just easily clonable and have been cloned often, or they are security overkill almost, including the passport, where the chip itself, from what I hear, costs $20, so you don't want to put that on a box at Walmart or break your business model, mostly. But even if money wasn't an issue, the embedding crypto, good crypto, on an RFID tag increases its size, obviously, and so it needs more power to be operated. And all this power is harvested from the reader through the wireless link. And the more power you need, the closer you have to go to the reader. So even if money isn't an issue, you can't actually use good crypto on the RFID tag in applications that need reading ranges above the 1 inch or whatever that passports can be read in. Academics has come up with few solutions or at least improvements. Feldhof and Volkesdorfer from Graz, they proposed AES to be integrated in RFID tags, which certainly is an improvement, but still would bump up the cost of a tag many times. And then what we see in the market is MyFan, similar solutions made by Philips or NXP, what they call themselves today, that implements some form of crypto, and Philips won't tell us what they do. And seeing this mismatch that academics can't find anything that they could implement, and Philips sells something that they claim has approved authentication, which probably just means it hasn't been broken for 8 years that it has been in the market and might not be approved by tonight anymore. And advanced security levels, where that already is a contradiction with the 48-bit key that they use. we do, however, see in the market that these RFID tags have an impact, a security-improving impact, in that cars, the number of stolen cars, for example, does go down as more and more of these RFID tags are integrated into car keys. So there might be some benefit to it. At least people with some financial benefit, car thieves, haven't majorly broken it yet. And this whole question, what did they do? What did they actually find something that academia couldn't? Led us to start this project where we look at the MyFair and try to reverse engineer the security of it. And then, as a second step, evaluate whether that security is actually good enough. And we tackle this problem from two directions. We do look at the actual chip that Philips sells to us and everybody else that implements this crypto. And then at the same time, we take the ambiguity out of many of the observations that we have through observing communication between the Philips chip and the Philips reading device that also implements this crypto. And I'll briefly talk about the second point, just so that you have an idea of what we did there, but Henrik will later talk a little bit more about the possibilities that we exploited here. We do use, as our hardware base, the OpenPCD, thanks to Miloš Meriak and Harald Felter, an open source RFID reading device that actually does integrate this Philips reading chip that speaks the crypto of MyFair. But it does only so through a microcontroller that relays all the commands to the RFID tag and back, which gives us tremendous control over all the timing, and we could, haven't done so yet, but in theory even change data on the fly. So a tremendously useful tool for crypto research. Back to the RFID tag. That's a photo of the MyFair tag. Is about a square millimeter, so a tiny piece of silicon, and we etched away a little gap over here, and zooming in here, we see the different metal layers coming in here, and you probably get an idea about the dimensions, and these different metal layers then interconnect the transistors that are even below. Well, what we did now is we sliced off layers of this chip and took photos. And that's what these photos look like. We have five layers of just interconnect, metal layers connecting what is on the lowest level, which are the functional blocks. So each of these little blocks encodes some AND gate or an OR gate, maybe a flip-flop, any of those. And so the remaining five layers are just so that those are connected to one another. And in theory, by just looking at this long enough, you'd know what it does. Well, it took us a while, but we the process that we went through to reverse engineer the functionality from just these pictures now started by deciding that we couldn't actually I'll go back one slide for a second couldn't actually look at all these there are about 10,000 of these small building blocks, and we couldn't look at every single one of them. So we wanted to categorize them a little bit before we start analyzing. And we observed that there aren't actually 10,000 different ones. They're all taken from a library of cells. And there's only about 70 different types of gates. And we ended up writing MATLAB scripts that, once we select one instance of a gate, finds all the other ones. We use computer vision techniques, template matching based on normalized cross-correlation. Whoever's interested in that, come talk to me later. We did automate this whole process and then had a map of functional building blocks on the chip, and now in the second step had to decide where to focus our attention, where we couldn't actually analyze the connectivity between all these 10,000 different ones. And we did analyze about 15%, which is still a lot of work, and the crypto is only about 10, but we were able to narrow it down quite a bit. What we did to find the important pieces of the chip is we just looked for crypto-like blocks, long strings of flip-flops that would implement a register, XORs that are virtually never used in control logic. We looked for building blocks more on the edge of the chip, sparsely connected to the rest, but heavily connected to one another. So that's where we ended up finding the crypto. And then once we limited it down to these corners, we went in with the images and had to, from the gates and the interconnectivity, then reconstruct the circuit from which we then read the functionality. Very painful process, did a lot of errors. Fortunately, there's some safety nets. If you see two outputs being connected to one another, that can't be. If you see the very structured crypto to have some variation somewhere, we looked again and we usually found an error that we made. We will, if we ever look at another chip, automate this process too, to get rid of this painful manual work. But enough said. This is overview of the crypto as implemented in the MIFA attacks. We purposely omit many details from this slide. This is the first public announcement that the crypto cipher, the crypto one cipher on the MIFA attack is known, and we will give out further details at some point next year. So if you do rely on MIFA security for anything, start migrating. at the core of the cipher, we have a 48-bit one. 48-bit shift register, where in every clock all the bits are shifted to the right, and then a linear combination of bits, an XOR, is shifted at the first bit position, a pseudo-random number generator. At the same time, a binary function with high degree generates a keystream, one bit at a time, out of this. To initialize this to a known state between the reader and the tag. Random numbers are used, both from the reading device, so that the reader has some kind of random number generator, and also an external random number is used. That is combined with the secret key, the tag ID, to get all the crypto properties that you need to make a stream cipher secure against replay attacks. I'll, for the rest of the talk, only talk about some weaknesses that we found. I won't go into further detail here, but as I said, more to be expected later next year. First thing we looked at is the random number generator, and we couldn't believe that. It's a 16-bit random number generator. These numbers are blown up to 32 bits, but they have a 16-bit seed, so there's only 65,000 different ones. If you had looked at enough transactions, you'd probably have noticed that too. If that's not weak enough yet, the value of the random number that is generated, the value depends only on the time between powering up the tag and challenging it. And from what I said earlier, we have complete control over the timing. So we were able to make the tag generate the same random number again and again and again in every transaction. One might maybe start arguing that on an RFID tag with all these constraints, you'd have to sacrifice something like the randomness of the numbers. We saw the same behavior on the reader. The reading device also implements a random number generator that we can make generate the same number over and over and over again. So we have a crypto protocol where all the randomness is controlled by us, by the attacker, which completely breaks the security. Depending on the applications, that might still be okay. Controlling the timing would require to be in the car to break the car, in which case you don't want to break it anymore. So some applications might still be okay with this, but this is cryptographically a major flaw. I didn't want to give out the exact details of this random number generator, but I figured since it's a linear feedback shift registers, people would probably go to Wikipedia and just look it up, what that is and what it could be, and oh, there it is. That's a well, I'm not sure who copied from whom. besides the random number generator, there are other weaknesses in the cipher. We didn't find anything nonlinear in the whole system, which means if you have one state of this register, you can, as intended, go forward steps, but you can also go backwards. So if you break any of it at any point, see weak bits, you can go back to the session key and even go back to the master key. Major weakness too. We see this binary function have some cryptographic weaknesses, which suggests to us we haven't actually tried attacking it through this avenue. A key finding attack that would run in sub exponential time. But maybe we don't even have to go there. Why not just do brute force? This isn't actually a system that we implemented. This is from a similar project at Johns Hopkins where they broke a related product. But we did start implementing the cipher. The cipher is meant to be small, extremely small, small enough to fit on an RFID tag. So we can fit many of those on an FPGA. And we estimate that with our implementation, it can certainly be improved upon. We'd need 1 week to break a key on a $100 device, or 1 day on a $700 device, or an hour on a $17,000 device. And if you're in the business of, say, car theft, that might pay off quickly. again, more of this to be expected next year. So in a nutshell, the MIFA crypto is flawed in many ways, and its security is, as expected, not even close to anything what we would want for good application. For some small value transactions, this might still be okay. In particular, I'm thinking about privacy here, where an attacker really only gains a large enough advantage from a large number of transactions, and if breaking each of those costs you a few cents, maybe the attack is broken. But for pretty much anything else, this shouldn't be used. What we learned from this project is that obscurity, well, what we see again from this project is that obscurity doesn't actually add any security. If anything, it hurts you in the long run, because once it is leaked, weaknesses are discovered that would before have been discovered in a peer review process, at least I believe so. We saw several weaknesses that can be fixed really easily without any cost overhead. The random number generator, for example, just by using a different type of flip-flop that is already found on the tag and other places, you can improve the randomness a lot. So obscurity for security, again, doesn't work. We are left with the question, though, what crypto can be implemented on RFID tags? And from knowing that nothing that we have so far, even block ciphers that are very small, hash functions, too big still, can't be implemented, we're really left with the question, where can we sacrifice some cryptographic properties to make it fit on an RFID tag? And that really will be left open for a while, I believe, but will need to be solved before these RFID systems are deployed in all these various applications and will replace passwords, PINs, and biometrics. Well, I was much faster than I expected, but I'd say we take a few questions now, and then Henrik will talk about some juicy details of what we actually did. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, what hardware did you use to make the photographies of the chip?
Starbuck, do you want to answer that? Can we get a microphone here?
It was a normal 500 magnification microscope, an optical one.
Yeah, and to take the slices?
To the slices? We use a polisher with 0.04 micron polishing paste. So normally, it's really straightforward. So normally you can use a 0.3 micron polishing foil. You can you will find on each optical lab to polish fiber connectors. So you can do it at home if you have a microscope around 500 magnification.
And how much does all the photography cost?
Yeah, what?
How much did taking all the photo cost?
I don't understand you, sorry.
What was your budget for taking the photographs?
I guess you can get a 500 magnification microscope for around 1,000 euros at eBay.
Okay.
So it's really, you can do it in your kitchen if you want.
Yeah, okay.
But you do see the dimensions in which we work, right? This is a scale of 10 micro, so this is less than a micron apart. You have to polish really, really softly. More questions? Can we get a microphone here?
I read somewhere that the crypto was based on triple DES. Do you have any idea where that rumor came from?
The MIFA family of tags goes beyond what we looked at. That the successors of this Crypto One tag or MIFA Classic that implements triple DES, yes. And Philips will probably help you migrate away from this to their own product.
That's a common mix-up that I read often when I Google for Crypto One, that some guys pretend or say that it was based on Triple Death. They're obviously mixing it up with the Deathfire cards that are the successors to these cards and have proper Triple Death implemented in them. Well, it passes. Allegedly, you can use a standard Triple Death implementation on the host side, so it should pass the standard tests and should work as well as any other Triple Death implementation.
These tags, after all, are 10 years old. At least the first ones were built 10 years ago. So the VLSI technology has scaled tremendously to allow for more and more crypto. But to answer the question of the origin of this, we haven't found anything even close to this in by design. This is a stream cipher used in a challenge response protocol. That there's nothing similar out there. So it's a completely self-engineered Philips thing. There's a question far in the back.
Yeah, the question here in the front is about first.
Is the random number generator only on the host? Is it not on? It's not actually on the RFID itself.
It is on the RFID itself. You want to have two sources of randomness so that either party could be an attacker and it would still have some randomness. So there's a random number generator on both sides.
So they both got the same thing, and they're exchanging mutually.
The one I've shown, the one on Wikipedia, that is only on the tag. But the weakness that you can control the random number through timing, that you'll find on both sides, yes.
Excellent, thank you. I'm looking forward to free tube fares next year.
Well, get an open PCD, get involved in that. I'm sure we can give you the firmware that allows to get the same random numbers.
Mm-hmm. A question in the back and then in the front.
So for controlling the timing, what's the resolution in time that you can measure?
What is the resolution to break the random number generator?
Well, what's the possible resolution in time that you can simulate? How precise is the timing?
I will talk about that later, but the random number generator is clocked with one clock every 9.44 microseconds. That's the bit clock of the ISO 14403. And I think we can measure with about 10 nanosecond resolution. We have a logic analyzer. I will talk about that later. And for generation of signals, our precision should be below 1 microsecond. I had some problems with that lately, but I think I can be in the area of about 500 nanoseconds.
That's fucking awesome.
Well, it would be better if I was below 100 nanoseconds. I'm not quite there yet. Question here in the front.
I have another question. When these type of cards are used for like passage systems or for the subway ticket fare or something, do they use unique keys per card, or is it the global keys for all of the cards?
Interesting question. We'll have to find that out when we are able to break the keys.
If they're deployed well, then they would use several. They would use different keys for different cards.
There is a trade-off here because the Philips Reader IC has an internal storage for about up to 32 keys, which can't be read out, which is not quite secure memory, but secure enough. So you can store up to 33 keys in the Reader IC and then use these keys, or you could generate the key based on some master secret in a microcontroller, but then you have to transmit the key over the bus to the Reader IC, so it can be sniffed on the bus. So you have a trade-off of whether you want to store 32 keys in the IC or want to transmit them in the clear over the bus. Okay, I see we don't have any more questions. Then, question in the back.
Some access control system based on MyFair only reads the ID of the MyFair card, and then they say you can get in or you cannot get in. Is it possible with the open PCD to copy that ID and...
Not with the open PCD, but with the open PICC, which is the sister project for a card emulator. I originally planned to present that at this Congress, but I didn't quite get it working because of the timing issues I mentioned earlier. To get that properly working, I need to have a jitter below, approximately below 100 nanoseconds, and I'm not quite there yet. But in principle, the unique identifier that is transmitted at the start of transaction is not encrypted and not secured in any way. I'll have something about that too in just a second or two.
But we will emulate the tag, yes.
And there is a second, there's one unique identifier that's transmitted at the start of transaction in the anti-collision procedure. And the unique identifier is stored on the card in the memory of the card, and you can read it from the card. That you can't spoof with this technique, with just spoofing the transmitted anti-collision identifier, but you can probably, or I will show you, you can probably spoof it through some other measures I'll present shortly.
But, okay. But to answer the part of your question about systems that rely solely on the unique ID of the card, that's what Philips calls basic security levels. Mm-hmm. No security level at all. But as long as you don't have a VLSI FAP, you can't actually copy a tag and make another tag that has the exact functionality and the same random number. So there is some security. But in any application where you could just as well bring in some device hidden underneath your clothes or any of that, where you don't actually have to have it to be an RFID tag, you can easily spoof the unique ID.
That's the OpenPICC. Looks just like Milos presented at last year's Congress. Has about the same format as the standard card and can, in theory, implement and send any unique identifier that you want. I'll have that now. Okay, for the for our in order to be able to play around with timing or to analyze the protocol in any way at all, we needed to be able to sniff the communication to verify our findings of the circuit. And the sniffing setup, I think we shortly described it at the camp this year, consists of the OpenPCD reader, or you, in principle you can use any reader that's based on the same reader IC, and an OpenPICC card emulator. Because the cool thing of these is that the reader can be set up so that it will output the signal that it received from the card on some digital output. The reader outputs the card signal, and you can set up the card, or it's set up by default, so that it will output the signal that it received from the reader on a digital output. The card outputs the reader signal. That's what you have here. The reader sends something to the MIFARE card, and because this is radio, it's also received by our OpenPICC, and sound sent out through a digital output, and the MIFARE card answers, which is received by the reader and output through a digital output. Then Milos has a cute little logic analyzer that you can connect to universal serial bus, and it can capture several thousand or 100,000 samples with 10 nanosecond resolution, which we just connect to these both of these signals, and then we get the reader to card and card to reader communication crystal clear, just as it was transmitted over the air without any interference and no analog signal processing whatsoever. Don't worry about that. The signal here is mirrored here, and just ignore that one. I did that in my encoder, decoder. Yeah, the signal here is not the real data signal. It's not the data. It's not 011010. But it's the module, the encoded signal. So this is from reader to card is Miller coded, and from card to reader is Manchester coded. But that's easy to decode, and we have a decoder that will just take the output from the logic analyzer and give us the frames that were transmitted in both directions. Two-way sniffing. Question? Micros in the back.
So, just to clarify,
So if I can actually intercept the communication on the radio channel between the card and the writer, when the writer is actually writing to the card, I can then brute force the key within a week and then write myself to the card, or write the stuff myself to this card.
Yeah, should be possible. It's a simple brute forcing. As soon as you know the algorithm, you can brute force implement it outside of the card, because the card will only do about 8 tries per second. And if you can brute force it in an FPGA, you can brute force it as fast as you want. And then 48 bits is not enough.
There's a lot of things that's going to change.
Start migrating.
There is some dependency to the implementation, because you can specify a different password depending on access level. So it could be in theory there is a different key that you don't see.
Yeah, the MIFAS system knows it has 2 keys per sector, and the 2 keys can be assigned different writes. You can have write writes and read writes, and but I'll show you something neat about these in about 3 minutes. You will be surprised. I was. Okay, and that's the timing setup that I have. You have the OpenPICC down here. You have just about any MIFAR card in the middle, and the OpenPCD and the OpenPICC up here. That's the digital output from the signal that was received from the reader, and that's the digital output that was received from the card. And Milos made me a neat cable, which has just a standard mini USB cable, which has a power switch in the power line, so I don't have to plug in and plug out the USB cable all the time. And on the OpenPCD, I had firmware running that was originally written by Harald that I modified so that it will just start authenticating and reading as soon as it's powered on. Oh, I think that's the original function, and I have only some output. And what I then did is, turn everything off, start capturing on the logic analyzer, switch on the power to the PCD. The PCD will boot its firmware. The firmware will automatically start authenticating to the card. The card was powered on at the same moment that the firmware booted and turned on the field. And it's authenticating, reading, I can see the output, then I stop the capture, get the capture data, put it through my decoder, see which frames were transmitted, and return to step one, power off, power on, and so on. And this were the first few of these transactions that I captured. I actually snipped out everything that's not the challenge response protocol. There's a mutual authentication protocol that's initiated by the reader. Then the card answers with its random number. That's 32 bits of randomness that are only 16-bit random. The reader answers with challenge and response, something they claim they have implemented, something based on ISO 9798-2, but that's actually not possible based on the length of these. That's standard mutual authentication. And then that's challenge, response, new challenge, response. That's one possible interpretation. We don't know exactly, or at least I don't know. Maybe Carsten has some more insight. And what you see now is that if I do that a few times, switch everything off, switch it on, and as soon as it's switched on, or sometime relatively fixed time after switching on, it will authenticate for the first time, you see that the card the card's random number generator somehow has a bad day and is outputting the same data over and over. I was kind of confused when I saw that earlier. I thought I had mixed up the files and was reading decoding the wrong data set, but no, that was the correct data set. And what you also see, that's the card random number generator. What you also see is that the reader random number generator is also not such a good day. It's not as often as the card, it's not repeating itself as often because there's more time in between and there can be interrupts in the firmware that will delay the timing for a few microseconds and so on. But it's actually quite often that the reader will also have the same random sequence over and over again. These were the first few, and then I have a collection of 27 trials. It's actually quite time-consuming, switching off and manually starting the capture in the Windows software with clicking and then stopping and clicking and exporting. It's not, can't be automated. So I took half an hour about to make these 27 trials, and then I grabbed out and set it and unique and whatever with a Unix pipeline, the mutual authentication pairs and sorted them. And these are the random numbers generated by the card and the first response by the reader. And it's sorted and every line is counted. And you see, this is our winner. This combination occurred 6 times in our 27 trials. And most of the other ones occurred multiple times too. So that's basically the random number, and the challenge response is completely broken, not by us, but by design.
But even if that weren't the case, 16-bit random numbers means you listen in on 128 transactions, and then after an expected number of another 128, you see one of the challenges again. So without any control over the randomness here, you will break it in matters of minutes.
Mm-hmm. And the Carsten didn't mention that number before. 65,000 possible combinations at 9.44 microseconds per shifting means that the random number cycle repeats every 0.7 seconds. Okay, and so basically we can control, I didn't intentionally insert anything into the firmware to control the timing. It was just so by default. If I had introduced some precise timing to not start the authentication procedure as early as possible, but at a specified time, I would have had the same tuples over and over. And if you can control the timing, you have basically, for example, a replay attack. You listen to one transaction, and then you make that card send the same random number again, and then can replay the reader side of the communication, and the card will do its same responses over and over. And because the MyFair cards have a parse feature, you can designate sectors or blocks as a monetary value, and then have a transaction that not means write something to that sector, but increment the value in that sector by €5, and you replay the increment transaction over and over, free lunch. There was another interesting thing, or much more interesting, a breaking thing. When I heard of Carsten's results, we were not quite sure how the initial state of the shift register of the cipher is set up. We don't know exactly. But he said that there are not enough inputs for unique identifier and key and all at the same time. So unique identifier and key must somehow be meshed together, mixed together somewhere before that and put into the state.
But we did see that there wasn't enough time for both to go in serially, what you would expect. So we knew they had to be merged in some way. And Henrik found an excellent way of finding out.
And then I just went ahead and just said, okay, if I flip the zeroth bit of the unique identifier, which bit do I have to flip? If I flip the zeroth bit of the unique identifier and flip the zeroth bit of the key, does the authentication still work? The way that I did that is with modified firmware. You can't do that as an attack on an actual reader. I have modified firmware that just ignores the unique identifier that gets sent from the card, but uses its own unique identifier preset identifier, and it doesn't use the real key but a modified key. And then I use modified unique identifier and modified key with a real card and a real key in the card. And so I just went on flipping. Flipping bit zero, success. 1, 1, success. 2, 2, success. 3, 3, success. 4, 4, success. 5, 5, no success. I flipped bit 5 in the UID and flipped, I tried every other bit in the key and there was no success. Then Carsten said, maybe it's I need 2 bits. Okay, I tried all combinations of 2 bits in the key together with bit 5 in the unique identifier and I had a success. 5 and 0, bit 5 in the key and bit 5 and 0 in the unique identifier. Okay, let's increment that. Bit 6 in the key, bit 1 and 6 in the unique identifier, success. 7, 2, 7, success. 8, 3, 8, success. 9, 4, 9, no success. Now comes the cool part. 9, 4, 9, no success. I actually tried again, the 9 and every 2-bit combinations and didn't find any. So I tried 3-bit combinations. I started with 4, 9, 0, success. And then I noticed a strange scheme appearing because 10, 1, 5, 10. I noticed a strange theme appearing because if you look at these columns, you'll notice that if you represent bit 0, 1, and so on as value, as some value, for example, in hexadecimal, you see 1, 2, 4, 8, 10, 21. And the interesting part is this cell is equal to that cell shifted by 1 every time. You see 2 shifted left by 1 equals 4. 4 shifted left by 1 equals 8. 8 shifted left by 1 is 1, 0. Except for this line where a new bit needs to be flipped at position 0, so I need to all in a 1. And that extends all the way down. I wrote a program which thus just did this. Try with 0 up there, go down here. Notice that 5, 5 won't work, so it tries 5, 5, 0, will then find this one and goes down, always shifting left until no success, then set the lowermost bit, least significant bit, and then store the new value and shift it left over and over. And that's what I came up to bit 31, that's the most significant bit of the 32-bit unique identifier. Those bits need to be flipped in order to make everything work with bit 31 flipped in the key. And that's the complete mixing of key and unique identifier. There are no untested combinations in here. I can, for every bit in the key that I want to flip, I can say which bits I need to flip in the unique identifier, and I can calculate that backwards for most of the bits in the unique, for every bit in the unique, for every bit below or equal 31 in the key, I know which bit I need to flip in the unique identifier, and for all bits in the unique identifier, I can calculate which bits I need to flip in the key. So, that's completely cool, because if I have 2 completely different cards, one with the unique identifier X and one with the unique identifier Y, and I can't change the unique identifiers, and key X, then I can calculate key Y so that both cards will start with the same cipher state. I can calculate a key for this card so that it will behave just as if this card, just as if it was this card, despite it having a different unique identifier. I can spoof unique identifiers in the authentication procedure. And that's without any knowledge of the algorithm. That's just, that's not even hardware hacking, that's just playing around in the firmware. And one possibility to use that is you need the card emulator, as the guy in the back asked, to spoof the anti-collision procedure and give it out a fake unique identifier. So the reader asks, give me your unique identifier. My emulator says unique identifier X. Okay, the reader tries to authenticate using unique identifier X and key X. And I've specially prepared my card Y with the unique identifier that I can change and the key that I calculated for this card. And even though both of these are using different unique identifiers and keys, the mutual authentication will succeed and both will talk with each other. And the reader is thinking that it talks to card X, but is actually talking to card Y. And that's cool because it's not quite improbable that you have this situation where you have a card with a key that you know. It could be the read key, but you don't know the write key. So you can take a second card where you know the write key, calculate a fitting read key, using this algorithm, and then you have a card that is completely controlled, whose contents are completely controlled by you, and the reader will talk happily with it and think it's talking to the original card, which you can't write to. And using this, you can spoof the unique identifier during authentication. For example, if you have, if you want to use an access control system and don't have the right unique identifier, and it's not only reading the unique identifier from the anti-collision, but also performing a mutual authentication because it's authentication, then you can spoof that too. The only thing that you can't spoof with this technique is the contents of sector zero. Sector zero is write protected, you can't write to sector zero, and sector zero contains the unique identifier, another copy. So if the access control system would read the unique identifier from sector zero, it, depending on how smart the programmer was, it could notice that something is wrong. You need another technique to against that. For example, which we didn't mention at all until now, it's common knowledge that you don't use stream ciphers and CRC for method authentication. MIFA is using a stream cipher and CRC16 for method authentication. In principle, I can perform a relay attack and flip arbitrary bits in the while they are transferring over the air. That's the same problem that VEP had with the RC4 and CRC. So if I know the contents of the transmission, I can arbitrarily alter it and, for example, spoof the contents of sector zero if I have the equipment for that, which shouldn't be hard. Okay, but that's a cool thing without any special equipment or not a lot of special equipment and completely breaks the UID and the authentication. And that's all I wanted to show you.
And the lesson to take home from this slide is really to use unique keys for every user, even read keys, because every user can impersonate any other user using this attack.
And those are the cards X and Y. I've modified the key on that card so that the reader, when authenticating to the card, the reader authenticates to both cards just fine with the same unique identifier. I've set up the reader to use a fixed identifier and not use the anti-collision, and it will authenticate to both cards and not notice any difference. Okay.
Thanks
a lot. That's working. More questions? In the back.
Hi. These questions aren't from me. They're from a cryptographer by the name of David Molnar, who wishes he could be here, but unfortunately is stuck in Las Vegas. One is, do you plan to try this on the Oyster card? Do you plan to try this on the Oyster card?
No, we don't have any Oyster card.
What technology is used in those?
They're MyFair cards.
Yeah, I know they're MyFair cards.
Well, we broke the Oyster card then.
Yes.
So it would be nice if perhaps you, when you release this, you could send him an email. And the second thing is, thoughts on building a secure cipher with similar gate budgets?
Pardon?
What thoughts you might have on building a secure cipher with similar gate budgets?
Well, the Philips themselves, they now build in the same area budget with a lot more gates, the DES, which is a 30-year-old crypto, and that seems the only standardized crypto that does fit on an RFID tag. But we might need to start talking about sacrificing some cryptographic properties to come up with new primitives that would actually fit on RFID tags better, that are custom tailored basically to RFID applications.
So Jake, to answer that question, there was a bunch of cryptographers designing a low gauge cipher based on this, which is called Present 80, if I remember correctly. Those were a couple of people from Bochum and Lars Knudsen, some people from England. It was a rather large team. And this is currently being evaluated for RFIDs. As far as I know, there are no attacks that break the whole cipher yet. So it's 32 rounds. It's a fairly large number of rounds. It's a block cipher. I think the best attack, which is unpublished so far, is 15 or 16 rounds. And that has, so the cipher is aiming for 2 to the 80 security. And I think the best attack right now has 2 to the 75, so that's theoretical still.
Is that the DS-based cipher that uses only one S-box?
No, that is, so this one cipher that uses just one S-box, this is a predecessor of that. This was, okay. I think, a diploma thesis by one of Christoph Parr's students, and Present 80 is basically following that line of research with lots of people who are very knowledgeable in this area and who have looked upon this.
Yeah, and that's exactly the right route to take, to have other people look at it before you sell it as advanced security levels.
Yeah, well, I mean, those guys really know what they're doing, but it still might get broken. So we have to wait, like, the next 5 or 10 years and see what happens. If you can't use triple DES or AES, that's, I think, the next best shot that you have.
Okay, thanks for those comments. Any more questions? We have a few minutes left.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
Thank you very much for your attention this last session.